What's up, Internet? Welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar. This week, I'm joined by Senior Writer Sam Rutherford. Hey, Sam.
Hey, how's it going?
Going okay. And also Podcast Producer Ben Elman is here. Hey, Ben.
A case of food poisoning couldn't keep me from talking about the Switch 2.
Don't eat old cream, people. That's the message from Ben and to all the kids out there. This week, it's the Switch 2. What else is it? It's the thing that we have been planning for and expecting to hear so much about. Sam had some hands-on time with it at a Nintendo event. We have live blogged it. We have all the details of this thing too, so I'm excited to talk about it. But also, it's really expensive, and we're going to kind of talk about why that is. And hey, coincidentally, the Trump administration also announced new sweeping global tariffs that will make everything more expensive, and I think it's all kind of related. And yeah, stay tuned to the end of this episode too, folks. I have a chat with the creator of Cowboy Bebop, Shinichiro Watanabe, about his new show, Lazarus. That was a really cool experience. He is like a creative genius. He is one of the people I think is just like a true genius in the world. And like his work, Cowboy Bebop especially, has really influenced me. So check out our chat. And Lazarus is all right. I'll talk more about that later. It's not as good as Cowboy Bebop. But hey, we got to talk to Shinichiro, so that was great. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes and drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. We also typically live stream around 11 a.m. Eastern on Thursdays. Maybe we'll start doing that earlier. We'll see. But you can see us talk about, maybe we'll have devices on hand. We talk with the audience. It's a fun time. Join us. So the Switch 2 is kind of officially here. We got a glimpse of it in January, right? But now we know what it is. It is a device with a 7.9-inch, 120Hz, 1080p LCD screen. The screen can do HDR now. That alone is like such a massive upgrade over the original Switch and also over the Switch OLED. It is $450. It's coming June 5th. Pre-orders are opening on April 9th, including some new games like Mario Kart World, which is this beautiful, beautiful like open world Mario Kart with up to 24 players. There's a new Donkey Kong platformer. It's called Bonanza. We've seen a whole bunch of things. Sam, you actually got to touch this thing. You got to play some games. What are your first impressions of the Switch 2?
Yeah. Let's kind of start off with like, you know, hardware and design. It is kind of what you think it is. I kind of, in my head, I think about it as like the Super Switch because it's got the same basic layout, the same basic design, had the detachable Joy-Cons, it's got a kickstand. And so, it's very familiar. And I think, you know, there's a good reason Nintendo didn't try to mess with the formula too much. They didn't need to. But it is a little bit bigger. It has a larger screen. It's not OLED. And I actually am not really that upset about it, because the new screen is really good. It does HDR, does 120 hertz refresh rate with VRR. And so, look, it doesn't have like the super deep blacks that you get with an OLED screen, but it still looks really good. And it doesn't feel that much bigger. It's about, a little bit about maybe an inch and a half wider and about half an inch taller, but it definitely doesn't feel bulky. And they, they've done some like little design tweaks, like as tapered sides, to make sure that it still feels really sleek and it's not really that much heavier either. It's not like the original Switch was like you could put it in your pocket anyways. You still need a bag to carry it around, and that's going to be
you could kind of put it I put the original Switch in a lot of pockets back.
Yeah,
if you got
like massive cargo shorts, maybe okay. But
I think cargo shorts are coming back.
So useful. Like you want to be able to hold a Steam Deck or something.
Talk about OLED and the lack of OLED for a second, because I was so sure that the Switch OLED was manufacturing practice for the Switch 2 to be OLED standard.
It doesn't have to be OLED. Like, this is exactly what I was talking about with the iPhone 16e, is that Apple made that extra expense to put OLED in a pretty basic phone when you could do pretty good with LCD these days. You can get high refresh rates and HDR, and those are the things that really pop to your eyes and really matter. This is also Nintendo, a company that will love to resell you another Switch 2 in a couple of years, except it's slightly better. We'll get an OLED version in a couple of years for sure.
I really feel like Nintendo is leaving that possibility open. But at the event that I was at yesterday, there was also a developer Q&A with some of the like hardware people in charge at Nintendo, and they basically said what you just mentioned is that LCDs have come a long ways in the last few years. And Like, you know, they specifically mentioned that the OLED Switch doesn't support HDR, but the Switch 2 does, even though it's an LCD and not an OLED. And so, you know, it's always like, you know, when you're talking about, like, you know, figuring out your bill of materials and what specific components are going into a device, there's always going to be some compromises. And I think, you know, they wanted something that maybe had a little bit more brightness to it, probably a little bit more affordable, although we're not necessarily seeing that in the, you know, actual price of the Switch 2. But I think, and this is kind of why, like, you know, a lot of people were expecting it off of coming from the OLED Switch, but after seeing it in person, I am not bothered at all.
I'm not surprised too. And it's really, the things that make a big difference are, it's basically, it is HDR, because HDR adds that extra level of brightness. I'm playing on a 4K PC monitor right now, and my eyes can tell, like, oh no, I'm playing Assassin's Creed Shadows and it didn't flip on HDR. You flip on HDR, the kind of grayscale-ness of the blacks go away, and it just becomes this really sharp, contrasty thing. Your eyes really respond to that really well, so I'm not at all surprised by the screen. Is there anything else, like, as you describe it, Sam? You describe basically a slightly better Switch. You know, like, it is a bigger screen.
For all intents and purposes, that's basically what it is. Now, there are, you know, a couple of, like, you know, more niche upgrades. Like, for example, the Switch 2 only supports micro SD Express cards now. You can't use your old Switch cards. And the downside of that is micro SD Express cards are a little bit more expensive, but they are significantly faster. We're talking about 5x, maybe 10x speeds. Nintendo hasn't released the exact read-write speeds for the Switch 2 yet, but that should make a huge improvement for, like, download speeds and loading times when you're booting up a game. And so I'm actually think that's a positive, even though, yes, it does add a little bit of the cost to, like, aftermarket accessories.
These games will have bigger Switch textures. Also, didn't it also support XD Express? It just wasn't...
I'm pretty sure that it just didn't at all. Remember, the original Switch came out in 2017. SD Express was, like, barely even a thing, or not even a thing back then, so...
So these new games will likely have bigger textures because they are running at 1080p. They can also scale to 4K. I don't think they're stuffing in, like, full-size 4K textures in this, but there's probably a lot of upscaling going on. But even 1080p, like, full 1080p, Switch games were not running that on the device, even when it was docked. So they maybe didn't always have those size textures. That totally makes sense. I almost wonder if Nintendo wants to start selling its own SD cards and just making some of that Sony money of just overpriced accessories. I don't know. But at the very
least, hope,
like,
not, yeah. Because I still think that Sony's proprietary memory cards is what killed the Vita and the PSP.
It absolutely did, because that's Sony. But it doesn't have to be proprietary, right? They could just be like, hey, we're Nintendo and we are producing these SD cards, and you can buy these and be sure they work with your Switch 2.
Yeah, I mean, if they want to make their own like Nintendo branded like memory cards, fine, go ahead. But, like, you know, you can still get your you know, SanDiscs, your Lexars, your, I think Samsung, I haven't seen any micro XD Express cards on the market just yet, although they announced it like 2 years ago. You can better be sure that there's going to be a lot more choices coming on the market real soon, especially when the Switch 2 launches on June 5th, because we did get that, you know, official release date.
That's good. But going back to, like, what it's improving, even the Joy-Cons, I hated the Joy-Con rails. I think within a couple of months of owning the first Switch, like, the Switch fell on the floor at one point and the rails, like, lost the, like,
oh my God, they're so much better.
That's terrible. So now the Joy-Cons magnetically attach. The Joy-Cons also seem a little more ergonomic. They said they made the thumbsticks better. Did they feel better?
The thumbsticks are a little bit bigger. The buttons on the left Joy-Con are a little bit bigger too. They're kind of trying to mimic, you know, that traditional D-pad by making it a little bit bigger.
Right.
It's not quite there yet, but hey, I'll definitely take bigger face buttons. And there's the detachment button on the back of the system is bigger too. And so you just press it and you pull straight away. There's no kind of, like, lifting up and down to attach it. And it just makes it so much better. And I think it feels a little bit more secure too. And because it's magnetic, it should hopefully wear better over time.
I think editor-in-chief of Engadget, Aaron Support, is pointing out, like, the thunk of putting on the Joy-Cons is good. And I love a good thunk on any device.
That magnetic, like, suction feeling is, like, very, like, reassuring. Yeah.
And the other thing I just want to point out is, like, this thing seems like it's decently powerful. Nintendo has not given us full details yet, but they're saying it's a 120Hz screen. They are saying some games can run at a 1080p, 120fps, which is going to look super smooth for really fast-paced games. But also, when you dock it, to your TV. The actual dock has a fan in it now, too, so they can crank the GPU cores a little higher, run the device a little hotter. And they're saying some games will reach 4K 60 FPS, which is wild to me, because that's something not even the PlayStation 5 can do consistently. So that's just the whole thing. Then there's the pricing. This thing is $450, which is the exact same price as the PS5 right now, the current digital model of the Slim. Also, the PS5 has been on sale forever for $400 with Astrobot. So this thing costs more than a PlayStation 5. It's not nearly as powerful as that. It shouldn't be anyway, but we need to see all the details. How do you feel about the pricing, Sam? Because I've been thinking about this. I wrote a piece about it yesterday where I actually think I think the price is justified. But what are your first impressions there?
If you had asked me before the event, I would have put money that the Switch 2 was going to cost $400.
Right.
And so to see that $450 price tag was a bit of a surprise. And I think, like you said before, I think we're going to touch on this later. I think Nintendo might be kind of factoring tariffs and, future cost of production into some of that. And that's part of why the Switch 2 is feeling a little bit more expensive than a lot of people. And there's definitely some serious sticker shock. So actually, as we're, recording right now, Nintendo is running a treehouse and showing off some more gameplay from some of the new Switch 2 games. And literally every single comment in the live chat is drop the price. Because not only is the Switch 2 $150 more expensive than the Switch, the original Switch was at launch, the games cost more, and the accessories, a lot of the important accessories like the Pro Controller and extra pairs of Joy-Cons cost more. So the Pro Controller and the Joy-Cons are, let me double check to make sure I got it right. The Pro Controller is $80 and a pair of Joy-Cons is $90. And those are both $10 more than, what the equivalent was for the Switch. Depending on the games, you're looking at $70, $80, or $90 for the physical version of, for example, Mario Kart World is going to be $90
World is 90?
For the physical cart.
Oh, man. Yeah, I saw the $80 price and I was like, that seems high. I didn't realize even the physical gets more expensive. That stuff is I can't really excuse. The game development costs a lot of money. Game prices have skyrocketed also over the last couple of years. But the console itself, putting this thing in perspective, the Switch basically inspired the Steam Deck and this whole slew of gaming PC portables we've seen. And from just the way the games seem to be running and the specs they're saying, this seems a lot more powerful than the base Steam Deck, which is $400, with a much smaller screen. A worse screen. It doesn't have HDR. It's also not great build. Steam Deck is a big, massive thing. This is a much slimmer device. You've got better games. You've got
It's definitely sleeker than the Steam Deck.
And just the Joy-Con too. You can't take those Steam Deck controllers off. And any other PC, I think the Lenovo ones, right? They have removable joysticks. Anytime I've tried that on any other PC gaming handheld, they just can't quite get it right because they don't understand controllers. I don't think the original Switch Joy-Cons were perfect, but these seem just a little better, a little more ergonomic. So,
definitely.
Yeah. And given everything is more expensive too. Let me just say this, the GPUs, I'm not justifying this. I'm just saying everything is more expensive because it takes a lot more manufacturing process and power and funds to actually put in powerful chips and things. The NVIDIA mid-range cards are now starting at $550. People are spending a lot more for GPUs. So everything is more expensive. Plus you tack on the tariffs that I think Nintendo was expecting. But yeah, go ahead, Ben.
We've also been through a global inflationary event. The original Switch was released in 2017.
Yeah, it's been the better part of a decade since we've had a new Nintendo system.
Exactly. So Ruindig in the chat asks, what is the price up from the Switch 1 in USD? I believe the original price for the Switch was $300.
Yes, it's up $150.
And so it's up $150. So between inflation and then also just manufacturing costs, the fact that GPUs are more expensive, it starts to make a bit more sense.
Yeah, so when I wrote about it, I was basically asking, is the Nintendo Switch 2 too expensive? And I think it's justifiably expensive given everything Nintendo put in there. I'm not saying, hey, I wish everything were more expensive. It's just kind of a sad economic reality of where we are. It's going to be tougher for people to buy. That's a whole thing. Who knows, even if it was Nintendo anticipating these tariffs, will the price get even higher down the line too? Because as we saw, during the pandemic, Sony was like, oh man, these PlayStation 5s are more expensive to make now, so we're going to raise the price.
Right, and so they were losing more money when producing it. And I think that's part of the reason why you're seeing that like kind of price bump, is because Nintendo is kind of give themselves a buffer in case the tariffs go crazy.
Mm-hmm. So it's a sad reality. I'm not like super excited about it. Also, like, I just realized it kind of hit me doubly because like I got my daughter loves to play games now. She really likes Mario Kart.
So now you got to get two.
Now I have to get two because I can't share my Switch 2. That's a whole thing. And also we have to play together. You can play together locally. There's also like a game share thing, which is a new feature. So you can take some games and spread them to other games that are nearby locally for multiplayer. That's cool stuff. I want to hear about your hands-on time with the game, Sam, but just to cover the new stuff, there's also a new feature called Game Chat, which relies on microphones.
That C button that like everyone was like the biggest enigma. Yeah.
The microphones are built into the controllers. You could just talk at your controller. They're having group chats. The way they're pitching it, though, it feels like the heyday of like 2005 Xbox Live era, you know, where we all had headsets. Like, oh, this is amazing. We can all talk to each other. I think Nintendo's 20 years too late to this. I don't know if it's going to be a whole thing.
Yeah? Also, Nintendo doesn't know what their primary demographic is, which is exactly the demographic that shouldn't have a microphone.
Yeah. And in my hands-on, I kind of describe it as like, hey, Nintendo has discovered Discord and kind of built all of the things that people like about Discord and put it in the Switch to like natively. And that's great. And it's hard to complain about that. You will need, I believe, to have a subscription to NSO to use them. So that's a little bit of a bummer. It's not, you know, completely free like Discord. And then there also is a camera accessory that, so if you want to like, you know, stream yourself or like, you know, whoever is in your group chat, they want to see you, you can do that too. And it does have some gameplay implications for certain titles, but we'll probably get to that in a little bit.
That camera looks terrible, by the way. Like even the demo footage they showed, like, it's like, this is...
It's a very basic
720p
camera.
720p sensor. Like it looks really super
and
basic.
It costs $50, so it's actually one of the cheapest accessories for the Switch 2. But, you know, what are you going to expect from, like, a dedicated $50 web camera?
It's a potato camera. Nintendo made a potato camera, basically. It's, like, kind of hilarious to see. Another feature of Game Chat, is it Game Chat or Game Share, where you can basically share what you're playing, like a stream of what you're playing to your friends, too, built into the console. That's cool. That's something mainly PC gamers do, because you can do it through Discord easily. But I think that's kind of a nifty thing, maybe more useful than Game Chat itself. But let's talk about the games. Sam, you played the Mario Kart. You played everything that they had to offer, right?
Yeah, tell us a bit about what the scene was like. Where was this? It was in Manhattan, right?
Yeah, so this was in Midtown Manhattan, and so they just had a absolute crap ton of systems and TVs. They must have had 100-150 different Switch 2 units connected to various TVs. And so I believe, don't quote me on this, that they are going to open up this experience to the public at some point. And so that's kind of like, if you notice in the photographs, some of them are like very dark because it's like the lighting is very moody, which is cool and very gamery, but not exactly the best for, you know, taking, well-lit photos. But anyways, and so they had just like huge rows of like booths, like, you know, they had, you know, 30 different Mario Kart World booths all next to each other. And part of that was because Mario Kart World can now support 24 players at the same time. And there's a new knockout tour mode where it's kind of like F-Zero 99, where you have 24 people. And then every few laps, as you're going through like multiple courses, the last four people get eliminated. And so you keep going and keep going until, like, you know, there's only four people left. And then whoever wins.
That's so cool. Yeah.
That was probably the most fun experience I had out of playing any game on the Switch 2.
It will transform college campuses everywhere. Because like when you have so much time, you're like, we're going to spend a couple hours just going through this entire map. I could just imagine how great that'll be. They basically made Mario Kart Horizon, right? Like, it's very much Forza Horizon.
Yeah, there is like a little bit of that like free roam. I'm not so sure it's like fully open world, but like they call it a free roam mode where you can just drive from track to track seamlessly just across different Grand Prix and different locations. And so the world feels a lot bigger and a lot more open. And there's also like, you know, little details like, you know, you get rain effects, which has not really been a thing in Mario Kart.
Weather and day-night cycles.
Day-night cycles. And so it like the world feels very alive. I kind of wish that like they would put a story mode in a Mario Kart game, which sounds crazy, but I think they could pull it off.
If they could do it for Smash, they did it for Smash, right? They gave us an adventure mode. I think they
there's a story mode in Melee. Yeah,
that was a big thing.
And some of the other titles, but I remember the Melee one the most.
I mean, we've been living with Mario Kart 8 essentially since the Wii U, right? The Switch version is Mario Kart 8 Deluxe. Feels like the better part of it, just like a decade, over a decade, we've been living with Mario Kart 8. So this game, and Mario Kart, by the way, Mario Kart 8 has been the highest selling game, like for the Switch by far. This game could live on forever. So this is, I could just see a thing where they're like, oh yeah, in a couple of years, here's a full, single player story mode adventure. Here's some DLC. Yeah.
And it's crazy because you can tell that this thing is going to get tons of updates, but the roster is already huge. There's like so many different vehicles to play with. There's like a jet ski. There's scooters. I think there's some planes in there. They didn't have everything fully unlocked, so I wasn't able to try everything. And like, you know, the roster of characters. I think you can play as the Moo Moo Cow
from old. You can. Everybody's pointing that out.
Yeah, the old N64 Moo Moo level. And it's like, They've just gone like fully bonkers, and I absolutely love it. It's like, and I want to point out, like, for all the people like concerned about the price of like individual games, you are really going to want that Switch 2 Mario Kart World bundle, because it basically makes Mario Kart cost $50 instead of like $70 or $80.
Who's going to be buying the Switch 2 without Mario Kart?
It is such a no-brainer. Like there is literally no reason that I can like think of to not get the bundle, at least if you're going to get it on launch.
Just looking at this game, because I'm playing a lot of Mario Kart now, because what I can get to do now that my daughter's playing Mario Kart is my brother comes in. He is 5 years younger than me. We grew up playing games together. He has a Switch. And we can all sit in the living room, just like have a massive race together. This thing looks like it's really changing the formula of Mario Kart beyond like the open world thing. Like the fact that what you're driving actually changes into a whole other vehicle. Whereas before you would do a thing where like, oh, now you're a hovercraft. Now you're an underwater.
Or you get like a parachute or like a big sail. Yeah, yeah.
The hangar glider sails are gone because now it just becomes a plane or something. Just really reshaping what this thing is, and just being able to, the free roam thing, you can just ride around the map for fun.
Yeah, it was cool while I was waiting in like the lobby for like all the 24 players to like get ready, I was just driving around tracks like free roam style. And there's actually like little characters that'll like talk to you and like, you know, so there's like, you know, they've tried to populate the world a little bit. It was really hard to tell how much, but like, you know, they have definitely put some thought into, like you said, kind of really changing up the formula to make it, you know, a little bit more open, a little bit more expansive.
This is cool. This game, like, I think this game will just like take over our lives for a better portion of the next few years. What else? Like, what was the other thing or your next favorite game that you played there?
It was probably Donkey Kong Bonanza. This is like, it's been a while since we have like a real like 3D Donkey Kong game. And especially because there's no brand new Zelda game, there's no brand new like Mario platformer. Obviously, there's Mario Kart World, but like, so this is kind of like the flagship like single player game for the Switch 2 at launch. And it's really interesting because Donkey Kong is like, I'm not even sure like what the pretext or like the setting for this world is, but it opens up and Donkey Kong is in a mine, and he's like digging for gold, and there's like banana gems buried in the earth, and Donkey Kong is just like a miner now, so he just goes along and he like is digging and he finds stuff in the ground, and there's like mechanics where like the ground pound will now like displace dirt, and you can straight up dig tunnels like down into the earth or up, you know, through rock. And then he also has like a ground pound and like he can pick up rocks and throw them at enemies. That's like one of his main attacks. And so it's like, it's really, once again, kind of changing up the formula for what you expect from like a Donkey Kong game. Cause it's like, this is not just like Donkey Kong's jungle land. Okay. This is this is everywhere. He's like under subterranean, going through caves, spelunking. Yeah.
But Sam, who do you think this Donkey Kong game is aimed at? Because you were saying that it felt kind of like a Kirby game in that it was like a little simplistic.
Yeah, it's like, it seems like, you know, Kirby games a lot of times are like very like child oriented. They're meant to be like very easy and like kind of breezy. And, you know, whereas like I would consider like, you know, something like Mario Odyssey a little bit more advanced in terms of like just difficulty and like challenging. And I feel like Donkey Kong Bonanza is kind of in between those, where like there's a lot of, like, at least in the beginning, where, like, I was just, like, running around and just slapping rocks for, like, you know, a minute, 2 minutes straight. And so it's, like, there's just, like, a little, like, a level of just, like, I'm just going to smash buttons and it's going to work out for me. And so, like, there's definitely, like, they've made it easy and very accessible. But, you know, as I was playing a little bit more, I could tell that, like, you know, there is a little bit, there's definitely more to this mechanic. And so, like, obviously, you know, I didn't have a ton of time to play, and so I'm sure there is more depth to it, but it's really interesting how they're trying to kind of balance, like, you know, accessibility with having, like, more sophisticated gameplay for, you know, us older players.
It looks fun. It looks fun. In the stream here, by the way, like, as we're looking at it, it's a little, like, I think the frame rate isn't as good as it normally does. But the other thing I want to point out about the Switch, too, is that it seems like 60 FPS. Just going to be standard and most likely 1080p, 60 FPS.
Oh, yeah. I forgot to mention, Mario Kart World was running at 120 FPS, and it looks so good. I'm so happy. I couldn't really tell, like, HDR as much. There was a couple demos with, like, the upgraded versions of, like, Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom that makes HDR a lot more obvious. But because of, like, Nintendo's, you know, kind of cartoony art style for some of the games, especially Mario Kart, it doesn't actually benefit quite as much from HDR, but that 120 FPS is so nice, especially for Mario Kart, which is, like, all about speed. So you really, you know, can tell more about you're getting an advantage in terms of, like, you know, that extra performance and refresh rate.
I feel like for clutch moments, the only time I really feel the difference of, like, super high refresh rate, so, like, 120, 144, and 240, is if I'm doing, like, sniper work in Overwatch or something. Like, a thing where, like, real smooth movement and, like a hair trigger, you know, click kind of makes a difference. So in Mario Kart, where a lot of things are clutch, I could see that being a big deal. The other thing, too, like, so it has the power to do 1080, 60. That's actually pretty significant. It also seems like this is a friendlier console for third-party developers, and that is a big deal, too, because it was the Wii U just crumbled because it only played, like, old third-party games. The Switch had a decent amount early on, but it was never even as powerful as, like, the Xbox.
There were so many games that, like, developers didn't even try to port because they knew that it was just, like, trying to get it to run even just, like, halfway decently on the Switch just wasn't going to be an option.
Yeah, so we're seeing things like, hey, there's an Elden Ring game coming. There is, even if they're
there's
older
a FromSoft game.
Well, there is a FromSoft game coming too, but there's also an Elden Ring game coming, or, like, a separate. Is it just, like, a different edition of Elden Ring? I guess.
I think it's, like, yeah. There, so the Switch in large part is getting a bunch of, like, ports, but, like, kind of remastered ports, to kind of, you know, play nicely with the Switch's two features and stuff like that. And so, yeah, there's going to be, I think it's called the Tarnished Edition for Elden yes. Ring. There's that Dust Bloods, which is, don't call it Bloodborne, but even though it looks a hell of a lot like Bloodborne.
It looks like Bloodborne with magic, yeah.
Okay, yeah, so I am getting that confused with Dusk Bloods, because I thought that was just one thing.
Yeah. So I was talking about it with some people, and it's like, I think Sony still has, like, the IP or, like, copyright to Bloodborne, mm-hmm. and then Nintendo yes. was like, hey, can you make us Bloodborne 2?
Can we
2?
Just
and
do a,
like,
Bloodborne?
No, we technically can't do that, but we can make you this game, and we're going to change the title and enjoy because, hey, it's going to be, I believe it's going to be a Switch 2 exclusive, and it looks a hell of a lot like Bloodborne, but the title's different, but hey, it looks good.
It looks like their typical thing. I kind of cackled when that was the secret game, like the one more thing at the end of the stream, I think. I was like, did they just steal Bloodborne from Sony?
Kind of.
They stole, like, part of the concept from Sony. But also, like, we're going to see a whole bunch of other things. Microsoft has said Call of Duty games will appear on future Nintendo hardware. This thing is powerful enough to run, like, a new Call of Duty. They have not announced that yet. But I could see, like, the next version, this year's Call of Duty, could be a big splash on this thing. This just really seems like, man, they have addressed pretty much all the concerns we had with the Switch 1. I'm still wondering, like, what the battery life is going to be like. I'm worried about the price of the new games and how that can be a new standard. But also, this is peak Nintendo, right? Like, they have finally had decent graphics power. They are really leaning into the portability aspect of it, too. This isn't a situation like where the Wii U. I think, like, by the time the Wii U was happening, I think even Nintendo felt like, oh, maybe the Wii was a bit of a kind of a fad. Like, it was kind of a fad to have motion controls in a cheap... What they needed then was a cheap box to save the company because the GameCube was such a disaster. And the Wii ended up being that and kind of a novelty. But you can't live on that forever. So think of, like, the company jumping from a sure bet like the Wii to the Wii U, which was a gamble, but the Wii U gave them tablet experience that led to the Switch. So the story of Nintendo over here. Anything else you want to highlight?
I want to call out one thing real quick when we're talking about like third-party ports is that Nintendo hasn't told us much about whatever chip or processor is inside the Switch 2, but we know it is made by, it's a custom NVIDIA chip.
Oh,
and man. It does support DLSS and hardware-based ray tracing, which I think is going to be like what you were saying. It gives developers a lot more tools to port games over. And I'm really thinking about like the Switch 2's performance in a way that like it's not lagging behind whatever current Sony and Xbox stuff can do. Obviously, that could change whenever, you know, we get a new PlayStation or Xbox, like, you know, down the line. But it's, you know, at least there's parity between all the, you know, the current gen systems. And so it is going to make porting and just like, you know, developing a lot easier for developers.
For sure. And I mean, we were talking about with the Xbox stuff. It actually doesn't make sense for Microsoft to do just another high-powered console box because Sony is so dominant in that area. So Microsoft is thinking about portables, kind of following the footsteps of the Switch here too. Sony is thinking about a portable once again. The era of having like a single box that just lives underneath your TV, like that seems like it's dying. Maybe Microsoft could rethink that. I'm thinking just make that Sakura Windows box or something, like make it more functional for us. But the old idea of a console just kind of seems dead, especially when like the Switch 2 can do all this. So any other thoughts on games you want to point out, Sam?
Because I saw some people mentioning
Metroid Prime 4.
Okay, I have to fully admit I prefer my 2D Metroids over my 3D Metroids. But that said, Metroid Prime, it's not the most graphically impressive game, and I think maybe that's because it's like it's been so long in development that like you know, they didn't really know what they could do with the Switch 2. That said, plays really, really nicely, and we didn't mention this before, but the Switch 2 now has kind of sort of like a built-in mouse functionality.
Yep.
Yes!
And I want to be clear, that works for both the left and right Joy-Cons separately.
Oh, so if you're a left-handed mouse person, you can use it as a left-handed mouse.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Nice. And it's nice. Kind of like they're taking some definitely like PC cues, because there's a setting in Metroid Prime where you can adjust the mouse sensitivity and stuff like that. And so basically what I did is like I used the right mouse, the right Joy-Con, turned it into a mouse, and they conveniently had tables set up in front of like the Metroid Prime stations, because you are going to really want a flat surface. You can use it on your legs, but I found that was like a just terrible experience. And so I had I was using the right Joy-Con as a mouse on a flat surface, and I was using the left Joy-Con as like a traditional controller. And I actually kind of preferred that, because I'm, you know, more of a PC shooter player, so I like having a mouse and keyboard. And that was very, you know, kind of recreated that experience where I have the precision of a Metroid Prime, or the precision of a mouse in Metroid Prime. And then I could use the left Joy-Con for like movement, you know, forward, back.
Yeah.
Finally, all my PC gaming friends no longer have an excuse of saying, oh, I'm more of a PC gamer. That's why I'm trash at this game. Like if this game was ported to PC, I'd be so good at keyboard and mouse. Now put up or shut up.
A lot of PC gamers are using console controllers now too, so that's a whole thing.
I think Mark Dell in the chat was asking, like, did I try the mouse on different surfaces? It should work on like cloth or like maybe like a couch cushion or something like that.
Yeah.
But you know, one of the issues with the mouse functionality is because when you turn the Joy-Con kind of sideways, it's kind of like tall and skinny, and so it wants to kind of lean over a little bit, and it'll still work when you do that. But it doesn't feel as stable as, like, you know, a traditional mouse, which is, you know, kind of have a wider base. I am 100% positive that you could either 3D print it, or someone's going to come out with an accessory that you can slot the Joy-Con into so that it feels more like a regular mouse. And kind of when you're holding it sideways, you use the shoulder buttons as, like, your left and right click. So it does feel sort of similar, but not quite, you know, what you'd expect for, you know, a traditional mouse. But hey, it has like all the basic features right there, and it really does feel pretty good. I was kind of surprised. I thought it was kind of gimmicky, and I'm like slow. I was like kind of quickly came around to like, hey, this could be a legitimate option for a lot of people.
That's a bit of like Nintendo ingenuity too. Like I don't want to, I'm sounding like a fanboy because I think this company is one of my favorites, one of my first loves in the tech world and the gaming world. But like this, who else is gonna be like, yeah, man, let's just turn our controllers into mice and let's see what happens. And then what happens is you get Civilization coming to your console in a way that you can play it like legitimately.
I played Civ on the Switch too, and don't get me wrong, like it's definitely a little bit clunkier than you would on a PC, and the load times were like, you know, pretty long. That said, it is a Sid Meier game. That's kind of, you know, par for the course.
Yes.
But I mean, if you want to play like Civ 7 in bed or on the couch or somewhere that's not a desk, man, like I would think hard about using the Switch 2 instead of like a laptop and being confined to a touchpad. I actually think it's a better experience with the Switch 2 than just being limited to a strictly like laptop touchpad for Civ 7.
And the Steam Deck has actual touchpads too, like on the side too. So there are ways the portable PC gaming handhelds have been thinking about this, but this actually seems a little, I think, a little more functional for a lot of people. So it's a cool thing. I don't know how much I'm going to be using it, but it's just cool that Nintendo thought to even put that in, because it's so not a thing I think any console company is really thinking about. You can't plug a mouse into your PlayStation or your Xbox, but very few people are doing that.
You know, and it's funny because Lenovo actually kind of beat Nintendo to the punch, because on the Legion Go, you can take the Joy-Con, but it's just the controller. Right. And then there's like a little base and you can use it as sort of like a vertical mouse, and they call it FPS mode.
Right.
But this is one of those things where like Nintendo maybe saw that idea and they have polished it to the point where it's a much more pleasant experience to use than anything the Legion Go can do. And so it's like, it's really interesting to see how, like, you know, the original Switch inspired this like recent wave of like PC gaming handhelds, and now it's kind of come full circle, because now Nintendo's looking at some of the, you know, PC gaming handheld competition and kind of borrowing features and kind of polishing them more for maybe a more mainstream audience that, you know, might not want to deal with a Legion Go.
I don't think we would have seen this screen, like this level of like, they're going to go to 120 hertz, they're going to do HDR. I don't think we would have seen this if there weren't things like the Steam Deck kind of pushing forward and the ROG Ally. Yeah,
this is a classic case of like, more competition is always good for the consumer. Like, you can't just think about the Nintendo Switch competing against PlayStation and Xbox anymore. It's all the handhelds, it's all the consoles, it's laptops, it's everything.
I do wonder, like, how, looking at this, I wonder how, like, what would Microsoft do as a portable? And the only thing I can think of, like, well, it's a Game Pass machine, right? Like, you can stream easily to it, you could download games easily to it. I don't know how effective that will be for them. I also don't know how many portables people can have, because actually in my house right now, I'm like, I got the Switch, I have Steam Deck, I have the one of the other, it's not an Io Neo, but one of the other like other ones I use for smaller games. You've got a bunch of devices now that you have to worry about like charging and juggling into. Like, there's going to be an upper limit in terms of how many people can actually do. Whereas for consoles that sit under your TV, the only kind of barrier there was cost for most people, because like you could always kind of fit in another box somewhere. So I feel like that's going to be a thing ultimately.
Speaking of which, there is the Nintendo Game Pass.
I mean, the Switch Online thing, which
the
is
Switch
sort
Online,
of,
but also the GameCube.
We get GameCube. Streaming. We get GameCube now and Switch Online. What do you think?
Well, I will say, like, we were at the demo experience. We were kind of watching the presentation live, and that the announcement of like GameCube games coming to NSO subscription, that got by far the largest cheer. And I was like, not entirely. I was a little bit surprised, because it's like,
of course it got the largest cheer. Think of the demographics you were hanging out with. Okay, it must have been mostly over 30.
Yeah. But it's like, you know.
Yeah.
So don't get me wrong. I am very happy to see like an, you know, remastered version of Wind Waker, you know, one of the most beloved Zelda games of all time.
Yeah.
But it's like, we kind of knew they were going to do this. There was that like GameCube controller accessory for the original Switch. And so, you know, there was kind of hints that, like, you could probably expect this. That said, the new kind of GameCube controller for the Switch 2, it does have a built-in mic, so you can still use all your chat features, which, is, you know, it's kind of nice.
Also, new GameCube controller plus GameCube on Game Pass means that there is going to be a Super Smash Bros. Melee renaissance.
Is there?
Maybe?
Maybe?
Yeah, I mean, they haven't announced the full slate of, like,
Do any of you guys
GameCube
know...
games.
Does anyone else here know about the Super Smash Brothers like competitive scene?
The Melee
community is so strong, and this was like 20 years after the game was no longer relevant.
Those people are insane, Ben. Like, that's the other thing. Like, they're never going to play Melee on a virtual console. Is the thing. Like, it has to be original hardware for them. It's a whole thing for all those tournaments.
We'll see.
I do want to say, did you play Wind Waker, Sam?
Yeah, I played it very good. It's still 4:3, which is a little weird on, you know, today's modern, like, you know, widescreen things. But it looks great. And it's one of those games where it's like, you could tell they've put a little bit work into it, but because of like the cel-shaded graphics and Wind Waker looked good back then, they still look great now. But like, once again, you're not seeing that like HDR-ness or like, you know, you're not benefiting a ton from 120 FPS. So it's like, look, I love that like it's available in a more accessible way, but it's kind of hitting more on that nostalgic factor than it's just like, oh, hey, like this is like a tour de force of a release.
I kind of feel like this is a little disrespectful to Wind Waker, is the thing, right? Like, if freaking Twilight Princess got a real re-release, like that game was not very good. That game was fine for the time. And I think Wind Waker, I remember playing Wind Waker in college on the GameCube, and like, how is this happening? How does this game look so good? The other thing is like hackers and emulators have been playing Wind Waker at like 4K 60 FPS on computers for a long time, and people have been speculating like this really makes Nintendo look bad. It makes the Switch One's hardware look bad. And what they end up doing is just giving us a slightly better Wind Waker via, you know, the GameCube emulation layer, and not like a full-fledged, we love Wind Waker, we're going to give it a full remaster. It is nice. It's more accessible because it's part of the Nintendo Switch Online subscription now. But that's a great game. That game deserved like a real remaster and like I wouldn't mind spending another $40 or $50 to get like a really nicely polished widescreen version of Wind Waker that looks even better. You know,
that's fingers crossed. This might be like an intermediate offer.
I don't think they can do that. I think this is just like, hey guys, this is the best we can do. We're just a little small company, and we can only do so much. Yeah.
Also, for all the like the really nerdy tech heads out there, during the developer Q&A, someone asked if these GameCube games are being emulated on software or hardware. And this is a general simplification of their response, but they said it's mostly software emulation. Which is interesting because it kind of shows that like the Switch 2 has the horsepower to do everything in software. They didn't have to go back and like, you know, farm out some like old GameCube chips and like shove them in the Switch 2.
That never was going to happen.
If you think about it, like that was not a realistic approach. Like, you know, like when they put the Cell processor in like the PS3 and stuff like that. But you know,
no, they put the Emotion Engine in,
right,
the PS3,
yeah, yeah.
Right?
So, for anyone who's curious about that, that's kind of how they're doing it. But that's more of a simplified explanation.
That's okay, cool. We got a lot of other news to get to, Sam. So, are there any final thoughts? Like, how do you feel about the Switch 2? Do you feel like the price is good for what you're getting and the kind of innovation you're seeing here?
Like, don't get me wrong. I really wish. I think if the Switch 2 came out at $400, it would have been an unmitigated home run, massive success.
Yeah,
I think they are still going to sell boatloads of these things at $450, but I understand where, you know, kind of some of the frustration where people have that sticker shock of seeing, hey, the thing costs $150 more than the last, the original model. And then, you know, the accessories and the games are also getting more expensive too. And that, you know, the economy is kind of in a weird place right now. And so I definitely feel that pressure from some people. I do want to call out two small things. It's like, I think the hardware is really great. But there are two titles that I think Nintendo is not giving like the proper love to, and that is Drag and Drive. It's Drag X Drive is how they write it out, and it's kind of like wheelchair basketball.
That's
and
cool. Yeah,
it feels more like a tech demo to show off because it's based around the Joy-Cons mouse controls, and you kind of push the mouse control the Joy-Cons back and forth as if you're like spinning the wheels on a wheelchair. But it feels more like a tech demo and not even like to the level of ARMS. If anyone remembers ARM back on the original Switch,
God,
it
ARMS,
feels,
yeah.
It feels like a tech demo that is designed to kind of showcase the Joy-Con's mouse capabilities, but not really a full-fledged game on its own. And I think that kind of sucks because in some respects, it's like a great workout because you are just like pumping your arms in order to move. And there's like, you know, it could have been like something more like a Rocket League type game where it's like, you know.
I was saying it was like ARMS X Rocket League.
There's definitely that feeling. It's just, I don't know if the depth is quite there. And they haven't released pricing for this game, but even at $20, I feel like that might not be enough. And I really wish they had just packed it in with a Switch because it is a great showcase of the Switch's capabilities, Switch 2 capabilities. And if it had been like, you know, pre-installed on the console at launch, I think it would get a lot more run and just more people will play it. And I think a lot of people might overlook it because it doesn't have the depth of Donkey Kong, even if it is a little less expensive. Mm-hmm. And I think this goes
at least
double.
$20. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I think this goes double for the Switch 2 Welcome Tour, which is just a straight up demo.
Yeah.
You know, you walk around and you go up to like little characters and it tells you about like the Switch 2's like features and like hardware capabilities. And then you like earn points by like answering quizzes based on like what they tell you. But the thing is that like they haven't released US pricing, but it's going to be about like the equivalent of like 10 bucks in yen over in Japan. So it's not going to be free. It's not going to be, you know, pre-installed in the system. But this is like a straight up hardware demo.
Why?
Like, it would be really useful for people to be able to like, oh, hey, I want to learn about the demo. And there was like a cool demo about like the HD Rumble 2 and like explaining how it works and, you know, how it's kind of different from, you know, what they did on the original HD Rumble for the Switch. And it's like, I think that would be such a good intro to be like, if you are not super nerdy and you want to know more about this $450 console that you just bought, it would be so nice to have it just right there sitting in the home screen for people to kind of explore their system with.
Like a free thing for you to download if you wanted, not like bloatware that came with the Switch. Like installed.
And Sony kind of did this with the PS5 with kind of the Astro's Playground. And it's like, Come on.
That seems a little egregious. The pricing reveal of this thing is kind of hilarious too, because we were so high doing the live block. We were high on like, oh my God, the hardware looks so good. The games look so good. The Nintendo is delivering everything we wanted. Then they said, bye-bye. We'll tell you more later. And 1 minute later, we saw a press release drop with the price. So it's like, it's almost like they definitely did not want to contaminate the great spirits you were getting from the direct feed. Maybe they had that thing fully produced before they actually locked in the price. I think that's more likely.
Yeah, I think they tried to give themselves some freedom to like, hey, what are these tariffs going to do? We don't want to change the pricing last minute and then have to redo the entire video.
Yeah. Or even just the like terrible.
And the terrible thing about price elasticity is also that it's very unlikely that the price of the Switch 2 will ever go down. So let's say these tariffs get voted down by Congress, because it can get voted down by Congress. We'll talk about that in a second. But it's very unlikely that Nintendo is going to be like, congratulations, everybody. Now the Switch is like $375 or $400.
Maybe in several years that'll be the case. So that was just kind of the hilarious moment. It was like we were so flying high on like the Switch Direct stream, and then it ended and we're like, ah, the crushing reality of market economics. This thing is $450. We didn't talk about it will play older Switch games. They haven't like released the ones that definitely won't work, I think. And
the round table again, the only one they mentioned that won't work is Labo, for kind of obvious reasons.
Yeah.
The Switch 2 is bigger and it doesn't like fit inside the Labo cardboard. But they said that they're going to put a full list of non-compatible games online at some point.
That's
probably
great.
Obviously closer to launch.
Some games will also have upgrade packs for like higher quality graphics. That's cool to see. Also the ones for Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom, the Zelda games will come as part of the Nintendo Switch Online, the GameCube upgrade pack. So that's confusing, but also,
and there's a little thing, like, I think there's a way to like view the like Breath of the Kingdom map on your phone, kind of mimicking how it was on the Wii U, I believe. But yeah.
Breath of the Kingdom. I am a little confused about why Nintendo gave the Switch 1 two big Zelda games. And now how long are we going to have to wait for a Zelda on the Switch 2? That's crazy.
It's going to be. I mean, the Switch 1 was around for a long time. Like, it had a really long lifetime.
I remember writing years ago that, like, we thought the Switch 2 or the Switch Pro, as, like, we called it back then, was going to come out years ago, and it just never happened.
That ended up being the Switch OLED. And I think it was probably wise of Nintendo not to like split off its whole thing and like, hey, we have a slightly more powerful Switch. Let's hold off on the Switch 2 for a while. They kind of just hunkered down on like 2017, honestly, 2016 era NVIDIA hardware. And just kind of rode that out for almost a whole decade. This is like if you bought a video card 10 years ago, like, I'm just going to keep going. Going to lower the resolution. Going to make it like work somehow on my PC. They suck it out to this whole thing. Feel like that's all of it. We're definitely going to be talking more about the Switch 2. Stay tuned for coverage. I know you have some thoughts you want to put down, Sam. We are definitely going to be looking at this hardware, and I already have thoughts, and I cannot wait to get my hands on this thing. So stay tuned, folks. Moving on to some other news, let's talk a little bit about why the Switch 2 may be so expensive. This week, the Trump administration announced massive, expansive global tariffs, a 10% universal tariff on pretty much everything coming into the country, but also additional tariffs on multiple countries with a weird formula. The formula was like based on the trade deficit we have with them. It's really dumb, really silly. Basically, a lot of things are going to get more expensive. And from some countries, significantly more expensive. There was already a 20% tariff against China. I think they just announced an additional 35% tariff. So 55% more for goods coming from China. That's pretty much everything. It's going to hit Taiwan. It's going to hit Japan.
Speaking of China, not that it's really tech related, but RIP Shein and Temu.
I mean, the entire drop shipping like idea of selling things, that's going to go away. The Trump administration called this, quote, Liberation Day. And I kind of prefer the Economist headline this morning. It's Ruination Day, unfortunately. So it's going to be bad, folks. Like if you are wondering why the Switch 2 is so expensive, if you're wondering why eggs are expensive or anything that you're going to be seeing coming out of Taiwan or India, too, which is producing a lot of like agricultural goods for us, but also some devices, it's going to directly affect the tech world. And the way I'm seeing it framed is that, oh, yeah, these retaliatory tariffs, right, the more expensive ones, it's really just a way to force other countries to, you know, buy more from us or reduce their own like tariffs against the U.S. or whatever. I don't know if that's actually going to happen. People keep framing what the Trump administration is doing as sort of like, oh, yeah, it's really actually smart because it'll make other countries behave better with us. Nobody thinks that. Pretty much every economic expert I've read at this point say like there is no real logic or justification to doing things this way. It's just going to be really bad. Like it's a really bad bullying maneuver that could affect the entire global economy and also the tech world. That's our kind of angle here. But yeah.
Did you see China, Japan, and South Korea all decided like, hey, we're going to get together and respond to these tariffs in kind? Do you know how much it takes to get those folks to cooperate?
Yeah, they never agree on anything. And I think someone said like the last time they agreed to do a joint anything was like 5 years ago.
Yes.
It's like, what the hell? But like, you know, okay, granted, I'm not an economist, but like, you know, if the whole goal was to bring manufacturing and industry back to the U.S., you have two ways of doing it, right? You have incentives where you like you can subsidize people or give them tax breaks and like make it economically or like financially beneficial for them to, hey, stop, you know, offshoring production to other countries and stuff like that. Or you can do what Trump's doing and you can just throw tons of taxes and basically punish everyone for, you know, the accepted behavior, corporate behavior of like the last like 20, 30 years. And so he chose the punishing one instead of like, you know, trying to incentivize, you know, people to do or companies to do what he thinks is the right thing. And now because he's doing the punish one, the whole economy, stock market is in just like pure chaos.
You kind of look
at this. It makes no sense.
You look at this and you see how this guy can bankrupt a casino, a thing which is really hard to do, incredibly hard to do. So anyway, brace yourselves, folks. Like I can tell you how I've been thinking about this and preparing for it. Last week during like a Amazon spring whatever event, spring sales event, a lot of things were on sale. It's like, I'm going to finally get into NAS. I'm going to build a NAS. I'm going to get a QNAP 4-bay NAS, get some drives going, really start up to save my data. Did the final total. Would it be about $900 with the NAS, two hard drives. And this is like before bad tariff pricing. Okay. And that was like $900 for backup, data backup, which is important. But I already back up a lot of stuff to the cloud. I have like stuff backed up on multiple computers already. I don't have like a single localized solution for me and my wife and my whole family. And I just canceled that whole thing because it's like, I cannot justify that to myself, knowing kind of where our economy is going to be going. And I think people are going to be making a lot of those decisions too. Some people made that I'm talking to are like, oh, I got to lock in my next big purchase before these tariffs really hit. These are going to have sweeping effects, not just on the American economy, but the entire global economy. It's all we can say right now is like strap in. It is going to be kind of rough. And we're going to be covering like exactly how it's hitting the PC industry, the electronics industry in many, many ways. But the basics is everything is going to get more expensive. Like, if that's the main thing to understand here, strap in, folks. As Samuel L. Jackson said in Jurassic Park, hold on to your butts because it's going to get scary out there. Yeah.
So another big thing from this week is that the TikTok divest or ban deadline is coming up this Saturday, the 5th. And there is just a bunch of news on whether or not like TikTok is going to sell, whether or not ByteDance is going to retain a stake. I just saw something in the information about how ByteDance might try to maintain a stake, or that China may still have like some connection to the algorithm, because the algorithm is not as scary to lawmakers now as like, I don't know, 10 other things. So we have a post up on the site talking about all of the possible buyers for TikTok. A leading one is Oracle. Amazon just put in a bid. This makes a lot of sense if you think of TikTok more as a shopping app via TikTok Shop than anything else. And I think that's smart because, I mean, it does come from China. China does like roll its e-commerce into its entertainment apps a lot better. You also have Microsoft in the running, Perplexity, Project Liberty, which includes some guy from Shark Tank, Mr. Beast. Like, it's an absolute clown car of people.
All Mr. Beast did was just like tweet. He just did one tweet, I believe.
but anyway. Still, we're talking about him. So yeah. Good job, I guess.
Good job. Amazon, AppLovin, OnlyFans CEO, Tim Stokely. So shout out to Chris O'Bell at Engadget, who's been like following this and kind of collating all this stuff that's been happening. We don't quite know. I will say some weird stuff is happening on TikTok. Like, people are saying the app feels a little different now after like it was resurrected through Trump's illegal magic, I guess. I'm still like looking at stuff there. I'm also seeing more footage like, you know, America has really lied to us. Like, the government has lied to us about China. Things are actually not so bad in China. There are a lot of Americans living in China. They're having happy lives. The government's not so bad. Censorship's not so bad. It's all like kind of like government, like US lies. There's definitely more of that out there. Just saying, hey, Americans, life is so much better in China. Just come here.
I have no idea. Like, the TikTok user base has a tendency to be kind of conspiracy minded. So the idea of people saying, oh my God, I never saw ads for Instagram on TikTok before the first shutdown in January. I don't know what that means. People were talking last night very credulously about the possibility that, like, oh, the downtime was just to migrate all the data onto Meta's servers, as if that was actually something that was real. That was so dumb.
People just like will stupid conspiracies into existence. Sure, but I will tell you, last night while I was tired in bed after putting my kids down, every four or five videos there was an Instagram ad, and there was an Instagram ad starring like a major TikToker too, like some. Clearly, Meta is like trying to get more eyeballs onto the fact that, hey, we're just like you, except Instagram creators use slightly more polished production and stuff like that. Anyway, there's going to be a lot happening here, semi-related to like crazy company stupidity. Last week, XAI, Elon Musk's AI company, purchased X, the formerly known as Twitter. Doesn't mean much except, you know, he can use the funding from XAI to kind of absorb the losses of Twitter. And also, like, the story was like, oh, yeah, it really values Twitter a lot more now. It's actually a way to save Twitter.
Yeah, so...
Go on, Sam.
I was going to say, if people remember when Elon bought Twitter, he... a big part of, like, you know, his purchasing power was that he kind of leveraged his existing Tesla stock. Now, as anyone has seen recently, Tesla stock is not doing exactly all that well. And so that kind of puts him at like at risk to get like, you know, I'm not sure. I'm not a stock analyst, but like, you know, kind of marginal.
You're also not an economist today.
Yes. But you know, it kind of puts him at a higher risk because he is now leveraged kind of up to his eyeballs. But by selling, you know, the debt of X along with everything else to XAI, he kind of shifts the liability, or the financial liability at least, over to XII. And, you know, that is kind of like a weird shell game that he's playing, and it's kind of, you know, kind of a little squirrely.
He's done this before. As far as
I can tell, that's the main goal of it.
This is not the first time he's, like, over-leveraged his companies. Like, Tesla, for many years, before it was super successful, was, like, on the brink of death, and he had to do financial shenanigans to keep it afloat. Go ahead, Ben.
For many normal people, eventually the music would stop, and this is the sort of situation where, like, a real estate investor or something ends up flinging himself off of one of his buildings. For some reason, I just think that that's not going to happen for Elon.
I mean, well, so it's been government contracts. It's been government money that's kind of come in, swooped him, and saved him. So again and again, that's the whole thing. We got to wrap on these. We got to keep moving. So just following up on Signalgate from last week. Hey, it was revealed this week that the National Security Council, including advisor Michael Waltz, who was the one who invited that journalist to the Signal chat for war plans, they've been using Gmail. Normal Gmail to conduct government business. So that's fun. Normal, not decently, like, secure for normal users, secure for consumers, but not super secure for government contracts. That's hilarious. I'm sure we're going to hear more and more about how these folks work. Let's move on to what we're working on. Anything you want to shout out, Sam?
Yeah. I'm working on some phone reviews. Can't say what it is, but you might be able to guess. I also got the chance to drive around the Gen 2 Rivian R1S.
Nice.
So I'm working on a review for that probably maybe next week or the week after. And still kind of playing around with the ROG Z Flow 13. Although, of course, as you know, Nintendo came and reared its head. So obviously that kind of took priority at least this week.
Took over all of our lives. I will tell you, when I was driving I tested the Rivian R1S, the first gen, I think last year here in Atlanta. And I was driving around to return it because they have like a home base, like a warehouse in Atlanta. And I was stuck in traffic, as you are in Atlanta. And people just kept driving by me and staring at the car. And like one lady, like a soccer mom, just shouted out, "Is that a freaking Rivian?" In Atlanta, so even
the headlights are like very eye catching. Like, you know, there's nothing else that looks like them on the road.
They look friendlier than any other car on the road.
They look adorable,
except for maybe a Mazda Miata.
Mm. They look adorable, and also the R3, the R3X, like that little cutie. Every time I see a video of that, I'm like,
everyone is waiting for that thing to come out. There's, you know, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And, but hey, now we can dream about expensive cars. Everything's gonna get more expensive because there are additional tariffs being applied against cars, against EVs, against steel. Oh, that's going to be fun times over the next few years, folks. Let's move on to our pop culture picks for the week. I want to quickly shout out a couple of things. I reviewed a Minecraft movie for the site. I actually kind of liked it. I saw it in a press screening with my daughter and a whole bunch of kids and some fans too. They seem to love it. It is a Jared Hess movie. It in some ways feels like a pseudo sequel to Napoleon Dynamite because there's some of that weird indie comedy in there too. I did not mind it. I also reviewed Lazarus and saw the first five episodes of it. This is Shinichiro Watanabe's new series that's going to be premiering soon on Adult Swim this weekend. We'll have the interview with him later this episode. I think it's a really fun show. It's really good looking. The premise is cool. It's about a scientist who basically is like, "I've been trying to warn you guys about climate change. Nobody's listening. Here's a miracle drug. Take this miracle drug. Racist pain for everybody." Then he comes back 3 years later and he's like, "Oh, by the way, it'll kill you all. This was actually a Trojan horse to just like kill humanity, maybe save the world a little bit." The idea of a disaffected scientist just like really losing it. It reminds me of when we talked to Bill Nye and he was just so angry. Sherlyn wrote a post like saying Bill Nye's pissed. And I totally understand because we're looking at a future where we are doing nothing to prepare for the climate catastrophe. Meanwhile, the people in charge of governments are like, "Let's tank the economy for fun." Things are real bad. So the timing of Lazarus is kind of timely, I guess. The show itself feels a lot like Cowboy Bebop Redux.
I've been really looking forward to this. I love Cowboy Bebop and Samurai Champloo.
It's very much Cowboy Bebop the thing. Like, I think maybe that works against it because you kind of have a similar core team, including the cool guy, the cool action guy, the femme fatale, the hacker teenager. Like, it's also very similar. It's just a little updated because Bebop used like classical jazz and it was like a more somber, slow, emotional show. This one's
also just hard to top Bebop, right?
It's hard to top Bebop.
when you're doing something so similar, you're gonna get that those weird comparisons that like probably aren't exactly the most favorable.
Oh, it's definitely it's definitely purposeful. Like even the opening feels like the Bebop, like the way they arrange the images and everything. And what Tanabe has said before is like, I put all my like ideas, I put everything I had into Cowboy Bebop, right? So everything that comes after is just like what I can like eke out of myself creatively. But anyway, the show is a lot of fun, the music is great, the opening is by Kamasi Washington, and it is fantastic. So the music is good, the vibes are good, it's fun to watch. It's just, you know, it's not nearly as good as Cowboy Bebop, but what is? And also want to shout out, hey, watch Common Side Effects. We've talked about it before. That's the new show on Max. Also about a thing that could heal almost anything. This is like really in the zeitgeist right now. And it's really about how the pharmaceutical industry and the government would arrive. Like if a mushroom could cure anything, potentially death, potentially like massive industries, would that be a good thing for humanity? Would that be a good thing for the pharmaceutical industry? What would happen? It's a really fun, quirky show. And honestly, I think I like it better than Lazarus because it's more inventive and there is some action there and like cool animation. So anyway, check that out. Sam, anything you want to mention?
Yeah, I've just been watching Daredevil on Disney Plus and
Daredevil Reborn, right?
Yes. And it's kind of everything. I was bummed when they kind of canceled it when it was all over on Netflix. And so it's like, it's just really nice to have like, you know, revisiting Daredevil. And they didn't do like, we're going to do a full reboot and we're going to like, you know, tell the origin story again. They kept the story going. And I think that's what I'm appreciating about. And they're really giving, you know, like Wilson Fisk the chance of like, hey, dude is like really kingpinging it up this season. So yeah, I'm having
last I recall he died, but comics are, you know, comic stuff is good in a comic, I guess. Yeah. That's cool. I need to check that out, Sam. I have not had a chance to touch that yet because I've been watching all these other shows, like catching up on Severance, by the way, too. If you haven't done that, do that.
That's it for the episode. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by me, Ben Elman. You can find Sam online at...
Sam Rutherford on X, unfortunately. I'm going to move to Blue Sky one of these days.
I see your username there. I'm tagging it, Sam.
Yeah. No, I'm there. I just got to start. Social media makes me tired.
I hear you.
You can definitely find Devendra on Blue Sky and where else?
At Devendra, you know, pretty much everywhere. Mastodon too, but I also podcast about movies and TV at The Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
Tell me what shows about everlasting life and miracle drugs I should watch next at heybellman.bluesky.social. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes because as the producer, I can tell you that actually does help. And listen on anything that gets podcasts, that includes Spotify.
Stay tuned for my chat with Shinichiro Watanabe. That was such a momentous interview for me just personally because he is such a cool dude. Let me set the scene. We set up for the interview. He is just sitting there in front of his iPhone in speaker mode, 1,000 records behind him, his entire album collection behind him, him in his shades, just chilling. He's not like stressing this. He's just like cool dude as always. And I think we had a great conversation about Lazarus and also about like his, how he thinks of music, how he kind of put it together and what he is thinking about. I did also a little bit about the future of humanity too. So I think it's a really fun chat. Check it out. Here's Shinichiro Watanabe. I just want to say, Watanabe-san, like Cowboy Bebop has been one of the most influential things for me. So thank you very much for creating that. I'll get right into questions for you. All of your shows feel very inspired tonally in terms of what you're trying to say. Can you talk about what led to Lazarus? It feels almost like a response to the COVID pandemic, but also a bit of a statement on the opioid crisis.
その通りです。オピオイド問題にちょっとインスパイアされて作った、思いついたストーリーなんですけども、ただし、COVID に関しては、それ、パンデミックより前にこれは作ったストーリーなので、影響はないと思います。
Exactly on in terms of the opioid crisis, that was a big factor for creating the initial idea for the story, but in terms of COVID, This was made pre-pandemic, so that had no influence on the story.
Gotcha. It's almost funny, though, because there is a very much an end of the world thinking here in terms of how civilization can end. And I feel like that's something a lot of people are thinking about right now. Just in terms of you, I am wondering, like, an interesting aspect of this show is that Dr. Skinner seems like a good person who was trying to help the world, and now he's angry about it. Can you talk about this construction of him as a villain, as somebody who may be angry at the world for not responding to the climate crisis or the potential end of civilization?
この story はまず、スキナーが一体何者なのか、彼が、いい人なのか、それともとんでもない悪人なのか、それ、一体彼が何を考えているのか、それを、まあ、彼を探す中で、それを、知っていくストーリーになっています。全13本の中でそれが、まあ、こうだと思っていたものが、まあ、ひっくり返ることもあるかもしれないし、揺れ動くこともあるかもしれない。それを、まあ、ラザロのメンバーたちも、そういうふうになっていくわけですけども、それを視聴者も同じように経験してほしいと、僕は思ってます。で、スキナーが結局良かったのか悪かったのは、最終話まで見て、視聴者がそれは、自分はどう思うかを判断してほしいというふうに思ってます。
Okay, so first off, for the story, it began more with who is Skinner and is he a saint or is he the devil? And exactly what does he want to do? That was a big initial driving part of the story. And in finding him, he wants you to figure out like what exactly he wants to do and what you initially thought is of Skinner at the start may change throughout the 13 episodes. And he wants the audience to also experience that with the team. And by the end, he wants each audience member to, the question was Skinner in the right or wrong for what he had done?
Kind of following up on that too, I've talked to a lot of scientists like Bill Nye, the science guy, lots of climate scientists who are very angry about the way the world is headed, that humanity is not responding to climate change or the many things hurting civilization. Are you kind of feeling the same thing too through Dr. Skinner as somebody who could be either good or bad?
もちろん、スタートの時点ではそういう感じだと思います。ただ、その後、じゃあその科学者が一体何をするのかっていうところからはフィクションになるので、そこはまあ普通やらないような突飛な行動を彼は起こしますので、それがまああといろいろなミステリーもあるんで、それを徐々に解き明かしていく話になりますんで、そのネタは喋れませんけど、ぜひそれを楽しんで見てほしいと思ってます。
Of course, that was the start of it all. So, his follow-up question was, so what would a scientist do in that situation? And as this is fiction, what kind of crazy thing would he do? But of course, there's a lot of mystery in terms of like what he does and why he does it. So there'll be spoilers, so he'll just leave it at that for now.
I would also love to know, how do you think about music when constructing a series? Do you have the style of music in mind as you are producing a show? Does it kind of drive the direction of a show? Can you talk about working with Kamasi Washington, Floating Points, and Bonobo? And were there any other artists that you wanted to work with that you couldn't? I feel like Flying Lotus would be a good fit here, or Thundercat.
やっぱりその自分の中で、イメージしている作品の内容に最も合っているアーティストは誰かということで選びます。単純に自分が好きなアーティストだからとか、それだけで、もちろん彼らは僕が大好きなアーティストですけども、それだけで選んでいるわけではありません。
So first off, when he chooses artists for the series, he always, tries to find the best fit of his internal image for the series. And while he is a big fan of these artists, that is not the main reason or a big reason why he chose them.
例えば、ボノボに関してなんですけども、彼は基本的にダンスミュージックの世界にいるアーティストですけども、それだけではなくて、なんかすごくこう、すごくメランコリックなメロディーだったり、アトモスフィアを持っている曲が全部そういう感じなんですね。そのボノボの持っているまあ、バイブスみたいなものがすごく今回のアニメに合っているというふうに思いました。
And for Bonobo, he's known for his dance tracks, but all of his music seems to have this like melancholic atmosphere to it, which he thought would fit the vibe for the series very well.
あと、まあ、フローティングポイントについても、基本、まあ、ダンストラックも多いんですけど、彼もそれだけではなくて、なんていうんですかね。彼はちょっとクラシックの勉強もしていて、そういう幅広い音楽性を持っているんですよね。だからダンスをベースにしつつも、そういうちょっとストリングスなんかも入れられるような、彼の独特の音楽性みたいなものが、やっぱりこの作品に合ってると思いました。
For floating points, he's also a dance musician, but dance track musician, but that isn't like his full repertoire. He also studied classical music as well, so he has a very wide range of things you can pull together. So although the track is like a dance based, he mixes in strings to make his own unique type of style.
で、もちろん彼はダンストラックも作れる、ボノボとフローティングポイントの二人は、これもちょっと重要な要素でした。なぜなら、今回、例えばパルクールだったり、アクションをしたりしてるシーンが、まるでダンスをしているような風に見えてほしい。そういう気持ちがあったんで、彼らのダンストラックの上でアクションをさせようという風に思ってました。
So, choosing Floating Point and Bonobo for their dance tracks was a big aspect since Watanabe-san's image for the series' action and especially for the parkour is that he wanted to feel like as if the characters were dancing in terms of the animation. So he wanted to fit some dance music to that.
ただ、彼らは基本的にまあ、なんていうんですか?打ち込みって訳せるかな?生演奏ではない打ち込みのダンサーの人たちなんですけども、ちょっとそれだけだと、まあ、いろんなスタイルの音楽性に対応できないんで、そこにカマシュ・ワシントンの生演奏を入れることによって、もうちょっと幅広い音楽にしたいと思いました。
Floating Point and Bonobo are producers who don't really do live recordings. So they're mostly at the computer is mixing the tracks. But he wanted some live sounds, so that's why we reached out to Kamasi Washington.
I think last question, because we're probably running out of time. I am wondering how you feel about the use of CG in animation and also AI and new tools. We've seen a lot of anime shows be produced using CG anime.And those characters don't look as real. They don't feel as fluid as, something drawn by humans. I'm just wondering how you feel about those tools and how it affects your workflow. How did you implement, CG in this show versus other shows? And how do you kind of champion the use of more hand-drawn characters?
これはやっぱりあくまで僕の個人的な意見なんで、これが正しいとか正しくないということがないではない。のをまずお断りしておきます。
Yeah, he just wants to preface this as it's just his opinion. It's not like the truth, whether it's true or not.
基本的にラザロでも生きているもの、生物に関してはすべて手書きにして、例えば車とかと電車とかそういう生きていないものに関しては 3D を使っています。
So just as a rule.Anything organic and living is hand-drawn in Lazarus, and anything mechanical, like vehicles or trains and cars, those are CG.
自分としてはこのスタイルが好きだし、ずっとこのスタイルでやっていきたい。人間を 3D にするのは自分としてはあまり好きじゃない。
And this is the style he's used and would like to continue using as it doesn't feel very alive when characters or organic things are not hand drawn.
で、やっぱり手で描いた絵、人間が描いた絵っていう手で描いた絵っていうのはどうしてもそこにやっぱり描いた人の気持ちがこもるのでそれで魅力がある絵になるんだと思っています。
And for hand-drawn, hand-drawn animation, in the hand-drawn animation, the animator's feelings and basically their soul is incorporated into it.
Ghost. で、やっぱり 3D が作ったものはやっぱり心がないと言いますか、まあ自動生成された絵なんで、どうしても手で描いたものの方が魅力的に見えてしまうと思います。
Yeah, and anything CG is just feels very lifeless, very mechanical, so feels very different from hand drawn.
まあただしメカニカルなものに関してはすごく正確に形を取るのが CG は得意なんで、その方が、いいと思ってます。
But CG also has its good points where vehicles and things like that, it's very good at those very precise details and those need to feel very, very lifeless. So it has its uses.
あと、ラザロに関しては、カメラワークを立体的にするために結構 3D を使ってます。
And CG we use also to have more dynamic camera angles for the layouts.
カメラの、いや、ムーブメントですか。カメラの。
For tracking different types of movements for using the camera.
ただ、これは、ムーブメントを見せるためではなくて、キャラクターの動きをよりダイナミックにするためなんで、あくまでキャラクターを引き立てるために 3D を使っているということです。
But the use of CG here is mostly to bring out the more interesting movements for the character. So it's character.First and the camera movement second, as a secondary.
Any thoughts on AI tools and how it's fitting into animation? Because I know a lot of people are pushing back against AI tools at this point.
僕は反対です。
He's totally against it.
やっぱりさっきも言った通り同じ理由で書く人の気持ちがこもってないわけだから AI が作ったものってそこにはやっぱり魅力的にならないと思っています。
Yeah, as same reason as before. It doesn't really convey the soul of the creator.
All right. Thank you so much, guys, and good luck on the launch of the show, okay? Thank you.